It's Girl Scout cookie time, and if you enjoy this yearly indulgence, you have an illustrious native Iowan to thank. This hour, we'll talk about the life and work of First Lady Lou Henry Hoover. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. First Lady Lou Henry Hoover was a geologist, a mother, a world traveler, fluent in Chinese, and so much more. Today, we'll learn about this remarkable woman, including her role in launching Girl Scout cookies. I'll talk with Tom Schwartz and Elizabeth Dinchel of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. I'll also talk with Stuart McLaren, president of the White House History Association, where 2016 is the year of Hoover. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Lou Henry Hoover was a woman ahead of her time. She was born in Waterloo, Iowa in 1874 and, along with her husband Herbert Hoover, spent 1929 through 1933 in the White House. But like her husband, her good work was not limited to her time in Washington, D.C. This year, the White House History Association is celebrating the Year of Hoover. We'll find out more about that and some opportunities for teachers to travel to Washington, D.C. to learn more a little later on. But first, we're going to get to know Lou Henry Hoover. And with me is Tom Schwartz, director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Charity.
Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Elizabeth Dinchel is also here. She's education specialist at the Hoover Library and Museum. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I mentioned that Lou Henry Hoover was born in 1874. She actually has a birthday coming up, March 29th. And tell me a little bit about what we know about Lou as a young woman, because even as a very young woman, she was rather unconventional.
Well, her father was a banker, and she had a sister. The father, I think, was interested in a male heir, which he did not get. The name Lou is intentional. And he brought
so it's not short for Louise.
Nope. In fact, it's interesting because the Wikipedia entry for years had Louise, and we kept telling Wikipedia, no, it's just Lou. And they refused to change it. Even though we were the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, I guess they didn't trust us as a a reputable source. Eventually, they did change it, so it is Lou Henry Hoover. But her father taught both daughters to enjoy the outdoors and to be adventurous, and so they would camp, they would hike. She had a general love for nature, and if you look at her early diaries, which we have. They're just loaded with all sorts of observations, both kind of routine, but also it's clear that she enjoyed nature. And so it's no surprise that when she enrolled at Stanford, she enrolled in the geology department, the first woman to do so, and she would hold that distinction for the next 35 years.
Wow. Now, I mentioned that she was born in Waterloo, Iowa. She didn't spend her entire childhood there, though.
No. Her mother had respiratory problems, and so the family physician suggested that they move to a more healthful climate. So they relocated to California, to the areas of Whittier and Monterey, which again put them in proximity to Stanford. And that was obviously a fateful choice because that, of course, is where she would meet another Iowan who had relocated to the West Coast, and that was Herbert Hoover.
Also in geology.
Also in geology, yes. It was fate.
Right. Well, and to be the first woman to enroll in the geology program at Stanford University, did she intend to work as a geologist when she graduated from Stanford? Was she intending to be a career woman? Elizabeth, you want to jump in here?
I think she did want to, but like when we look at some of her work, she translated Dewey Metallica. We see Herbert Hoover's name on it, even though we know she's the one that did the translation. She would have been suppressed from being an active scientist, but that didn't really stop her. She was still collecting and sending specimens to Stanford her whole life. And there was actually a quote from one of the Girl Scout leaders that said she would chase around bugs to capture them as specimen instead of running away from them like all of the other women were doing. But what do you think, Tom, more about her career?
Well, you know, when she originally enrolled, all of the men in the program dismissed her. And she ended up being more fit than most of them in dealing with the field work. She was very athletic and had a very good constitution, didn't mind the deprivations of being outside and, you know, having kind of bad food and having to sleep on the ground. And that's kind of a quality she shared with her husband, which is why she didn't mind traveling the world with him and going to these most remote and desolate places. The one thing about, you know, Hoover as a mining engineer is that all the places that he went to were not the very nice urban populations with amenities, but they were the backwater regions where the minerals and ores were, in deserts and, you know, mountain regions and jungles. And Lou didn't mind. She went with him. And I think both of them saw this, you know, early part of their life as this kind of wonderful adventure that they shared together. I think Lou would have preferred a professional life, but she also didn't mind sharing that life in a way with her husband. So when they did Day Ray Metallica, they had a division of labor. She actually did the translation, and there were a number of people that they hired to help with translation.
And explain to us what Day Ray Metallica is.
It is a 16th century mining text, and it was considered to be a basic reference work for people who were interested in mining engineering. In towns in Europe that where mining was the main profession of the town, these copies of Dewey Metallica were chained to the altar. They were considered to be that valuable. And it was written by a German in Latin. And so the Hoovers discovered – at first they thought, we can just take this and translate it. And Lou was fluent in anywhere from 5 to 7 languages, and Latin was one of them. So when she started translating it, she realized that there were several problems. Number one, the author was making references to things that – and that they realized they didn't know what body of knowledge was available to them. You know, what was he referencing in this book? And so they had to start collecting other books from that time period and before to get an idea of the context of what Agricola was talking about. The second problem was that there were various mining processes that he was referencing, and there were no Latin words for them, and so he had to invent them. And so that's where Herbert Hoover came in. Herbert Hoover was given the task of actually doing the experiments, the scientific experiments, to figure out, you know, is he referencing this, you know, refining process or this one? And so it ended up taking them 7 years, $20,000. And 2,000 copies were published in 1912. Now, they just didn't publish it. they decided that they wanted to publish it in a way that incorporated all of the bookmaking techniques from the 16th century. So they identified a special paper maker to get the rag paper that was contemporaneous with that period. They had vellum covers. They had it hand-sewn. They even had the woodcuts from the original volume reproduced. So you can understand why it ended up costing them so much money. And then they didn't really even sell it. They gave most of them away to friends. If you got a copy of De Re Metallica signed by Lou and Bert Hoover, it indicated that you were one of their special friends.
I think this whole story really illustrates how well-suited they were to each other. And it yep. strikes me that, well, I mean, going back to their marriage, the fact that they waited to get married until Lou graduated from Stanford, I think is really significant. But as they proceeded and worked as partners, of course, as husband and wife, but also in geology and in this effort, it strikes me that it says a lot about who they were and how they thought about each other.
Yeah, I mean, I think they felt very comfortable letting the other take the lead. And both of them didn't have huge egos. And both of them felt that the important thing was to have people discover their own potential from within and to develop their own leadership skills and their own leadership styles. And I mean, and I think that's reflected in kind of Lou's approach to Girl Scouts.
And we will talk about Girl Scouts in a little while. Let's talk about, and we'll start and probably have to continue after the break. Let's talk about Lou as a mother. I mean, after Lou and Herbert were married, they traveled the world for his career. They went to China. They traveled many other places. Where do kids fit into this story? Elizabeth?
Lou was crazy about her kids. I mean, she really loved them, and I think they were both really protective of the kids. But if you ever come to the museum, you'll see in the Lou exhibit section that Lou was on her passport with her children, which is something that we wouldn't do now. But she took them everywhere with her. And you can see, we always say necessity is the mother of invention, right? So there's some things you can see in her gallery that when they had the baby on ships, the baby couldn't sleep in a regular bassinet because the ship moves. So she invented this kind of bassinet that gave, so it moved up and down, and it was on wheels, so it would roll side to side, so the baby wouldn't be knocked out of its bassinet. Oh. And the little leashes we see on children now, they did those for the babies on the ships, so they wouldn't go overboard and get into messes and things like that.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about the life and work of First Lady Lou Henry Hoover. We'll continue our conversation in a moment with me, Tom Schwartz, and Elizabeth Dinschel from the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Lou Henry Hoover, First Lady, of course, along with her husband, President Herbert Hoover. And she's also a native Iowan, born in Waterloo, Iowa in 1874. Her birthday is coming up March 29th, and there will be a Lou Hoover birthday celebration at the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. And with me this hour, I have Tom Schwartz, director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, and Elizabeth Dinschel, who is education specialist at the library and museum. And Tom, the birthday celebration is coming up. How do you celebrate Lou's birthday?
Well, with Girl Scout cookies, of course.
All right. So let's explain that. And what was her affiliation with the Girl Scouts?
Lou had been both the head of her own troop, Troop 8, in Washington, D.C., but she also had several positions with the national organization, both as president and on the board. And in the 20s, when she was the president of the organization, local chapters had baked cookies and had sold them. And in fact, there was a recipe that was sent to chapters on how to bake your own cookies. But it was Lou that actually is credited with having a national bakery bake them and box them. And so the cookie sales that we know of today, which I guess are ongoing. If you can't go anywhere without seeing a table and some Girl Scouts there, it's a great fundraiser for the organization. What we decided to do is just to support the local chapter, the local troop, and we bought a bunch of cookies and different varieties, and we will have them in the lobby. And so if people come to the lobby on her birthday, they can avail themselves to some free Girl Scout cookies. At 11 o'clock that morning, we will have a program that our audiovisual archivist, Lynn Smith, will be offering on Lou Henry Hoover, First Lady Photographer. And that was another one of Lou's passions. She you could look at her early diaries, but she also did sketchbooks. She had was a wonderful artist, had a great visual sense of design. And so when still photography came out, we have lots of still photos that Lou took on their trips abroad to China, Australia, Burma, London. And then when home movies came along, she immediately became a home movie photographer. And one of the exciting things that we discovered was that these movies that we had in our collection that we thought were black and white, they certainly look black and white if you held them up, had these lines in it. Well, actually, that was a very early form of color film that Kodak had developed. And so run through the proper projector, the lines refract the light to bring the color.
Oh, wow.
And so we've sent those out. The film has been digitized, and now the process with a software program is to actually bring that color back. And so hopefully in a couple months we will have that, the digital files of these color films, which we will then announce and show to the public.
What kinds of films did she take? Do we know?
There are lots of films as First Lady in the White House. So that, you know, again, makes it special because they're the first color films of the White House taken by a sitting First Lady. One of them indicates that it's the Easter egg roll on the White House lawn. So we're just as eager as everyone else to just see what kind of hidden gems are on the film.
This sounds like an archivist's dream.
Well, you know, the thing is that in every collection, they're just wonderful hidden gems. This is what makes working in a research library so much fun.
And Elizabeth, I want to return to the Girl Scouts for just a little while. Why do you think this was such a passion of Lou Henry Hoover's?
Lou believed in girls and women, and we see this from a very early age with her. She wrote kind of a little manifesto about being an independent woman, and she was still a teenager at the time that she had written it. But when she stepped into the role of leadership position at Girl Scouts, she started establishing leadership programs at universities all over the country to turn women into leaders. And she thought that leadership really started with mothers because the children would exemplify mothers and turn into leaders. And some of the things that she dismissed about the Girl Scouts was the whole domestic aspect of it and cooking, because she didn't cook. She didn't do any of that stuff. She wanted them to camp. A good example of how she wanted to turn them into leaders was they had built a camp with Lou's permission, and she actually had designed the bridge for the Girl Scout camp and things like that. And they had asked for furniture. So she designed a chair and a table, made one, and sent them the design plans for it and said, "Now you make it." Because she didn't want them to just be be handed things. She wanted them to learn how to build things and to be responsible for their actions and to teach others how to do it as well. And it was all part of this leadership philosophy that she had. And when you look at her correspondence, especially from Troubate, there would be requests for letters of recommendation from Lou. And so she would write letters of recommendation and send them in. And sometimes if she heard someone got married while there was a letter of recommendation pending, she would say, oh, well, now I guess there's no use for this letter of recommendation. And you could hear her disappointment that came through in the tone of her letters, which was sad. She wanted women to continue down the path of leadership and working in spite of becoming married or becoming a mother. And she wanted to encourage them to go to college. And she held these elaborate leadership conferences. And she really saw Girl Scouts as a platform to develop women into leaders. And it's really impressive to read what she thought about Girl Scouts and how she thought it was molding women into leaders. It's just, she was really invested in it, I think, personally and even maybe professionally, because she was mentoring some of these girls. And at a leadership level, we talked about Girl Scout cookie sales. She looked at the books of Girl Scouts and said, this isn't feasible. We can't continue to support this organization the way that it's moving. We need to figure out how to make money. And so she started selling the Girl Scout cookies, but they also started coffee houses and waffle houses in Washington, D.C., and started having auctions. So people would deliver things and they would auction them. And in the correspondence, one of the interesting things they got donated to them was White House china. And she said, well, what is this White House china? Let's have it looked at. And it was from Teddy Roosevelt's presidency. They didn't know why it came to them, how it came to them, and they auctioned it. So they sold it and made money for the Girl Scouts. But she kept really good records of the Girl Scouts, too. And we have some of that at the Hoover, and we've talked to Girl Scouts. They have some records in D.C. But Lou, she kept these scrapbooks, and we show them to Girl Scouts when they come. And one of my favorite things that Lou did was she made comments in the margins in the scrapbooks. And often it was saying that the press got something wrong. And she wouldn't address them directly because she was a very classy lady and was not arguing with the press. But there was this one article in particular from a leadership conference in Boston. And a reporter had said, how does it feel to be married to the most popular man in the world? And she replied, I don't know, because we're not here to talk about him. We're here to talk about me and the Girl Scouts. And she writes in the margins, yeah, I said that. And so she was constantly keeping track of what was going on with the Girl Scouts and paying these scrapbook companies. And in her honor, we host Girl Scouts anywhere between 200 to 600 Girl Scouts per year. Last year, we had buses that came from all over the country that stopped at the Hoover on their way to the Juliet Gordon Low House, which was wonderful. And we have a special Lou Henry Hoover fun patch, and they would do that with us. We also do the Laura Ingalls Wilder badge on site with Girl Scouts as well. But this year, right after her birthday, on April 2nd, we're doing the Lou Henry Hoover badge again. And when we get into the archives, one of the things we show the girls is some of the things they had to do for domestic badges in the early 1900s. And it's funny to see their reaction to it, because Girl Scouts is back to leadership and not pushing domestic skills. So they're a little taken aback by that. But we do games from Lou's travels. We do games from Japan while they're on site. We do tours of the galleries and talk specifically about Lou and her accomplishments. We go into the archives and look at some of the records from Troubate and the scrapbooks. It's a really great day. And we go up to the gravesite and we say the Girl Scout promise and have cookies and punch, and the girls take pictures, and it's really a great day. It's really great.
And again, that's coming up on April 2nd this year, Girl Scout Day. And I mentioned again the Lou Hoover's birthday celebration on March 29th. So you have some exciting things coming up. And also this year, 2016, is the year of Hoover with the White House History Association. And we have Stuart McLaren on the line with us, president of the White House History Association. Hello, Stuart.
Hello, Charity. It's great to be with you. And I've enjoyed listening to Tom and Elizabeth. talk about Lou Hoover. I've learned quite a bit.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And explain to me, what does it mean to have the year of Hoover? What is this about?
Well, the White House Historical Association was founded in 1961 by another iconic great First Lady, Jacqueline Kennedy, who had the foresight in her time to know that the White House would need a private partner to provide private funding for the art and acquisitions that were needed for the White House, as well as for educational programs to teach and tell the wonderful stories of White House history. And one of the ways that we do that is each year we have the official White House Christmas ornament. It's now in its 36th year, and it's the principal funding for our work. And we have quite a following, and you can look at this year's ornament at our website, which is whitehousehistory.org. But each year we honor a different president. We honor them sequentially. And we come up on Herbert Hoover this year. And you might think, okay, Herbert Hoover is not the 36th president, and this is our 36th year. We've also honored key years in White House history, like the bicentennial of the White House. So we'll pause that sequential honoring of presidents. But this year it's Herbert Hoover, and we tell with this ornament that wonderful story of Christmas Eve on 1929, the first Hoover Christmas in the White House, when they were entertaining a group of children in the East Wing, and word came from the chief usher that their fire had broken out in the Oval Office in the West Wing. And President Hoover immediately rushed over and others, and they took out as many papers as they could carry and the presidential flag, and they were pulling drawers out of the president's desk.
And the president himself was involved in that?
The president himself, with his cigar in mouth and overcoat on, was involved in extricating these important papers as best they could. And there were 130 firefighters and 19 engine companies that responded. In fact, next week, I'm visiting with the fire chief here in Washington, and engine company number one that was part of that response, to talk with them about this wonderful historic story. So all of that to say, this year's ornament is this beautiful vintage 1928 fire truck that you can see on our website, whitehousehistory.org, and they're also available for sale there at the Hoover Library in West Branch. I know Tom I think they've sold quite a few already, and would love to sell you some more. But it's a wonderful teaching tool to tell the story of this historic night in the Hoover White House. And there's one more evolution of the fire truck story. The next Christmas, the Hoovers gave a toy fire truck to the children who had been at that party the year before and other children to commemorate that occasion.
So it's a wonderful symbol of not maybe the merriest of Christmases.
Well, you know, I think our first responders are very important people in our world and in our lives. And every day in the life of the White House, I'm looking out my window right now across Lafayette Park to the White House itself. And there are first responders all around. And it's still this engine company number one today that will respond to any fire-related emergency at the White House. So it's an important part of our lives and a colorful story from the Hoover presidency. But it's thousands of these stories that go on every that have gone on throughout the history of the White House that make it such a wonderful storytelling subject for our work.
So we were talking earlier about Lou Henry Hoover and her love of photography and her early adoption of video technology of the time. So as part of the White House Historical Association, that must be very exciting to you to think about getting your hands on films taken in the White House. I mean, that's incredible documentation.
It is. We actually have possession of almost 60,000 unique images of White House history, and there would be many in that collection that would come from the Hoover years. But we have just launched this past week our own digital library collection, which is on our website, whitehousehistory.org. And we started with initial 2,000, I think, and it will ramp up to 60,000 and over the next 2 years. And these will now be publicly accessible, searchable, with all kinds of research and data supporting each one that have not been available in this format before. So we really are honored to have that. But, you know, for us in the conversation today, 2016 is the year of Herbert Hoover for us, and we look forward to collaborating with the library there and Tom and his colleagues. And we have a wonderful partnership with the Washington Nationals baseball team here in Washington that will feature Herbert Hoover throughout the course of the baseball season, all 81 home games. There will be a recognition of President Hoover and his connection with us and this Christmas ornament and teaching and telling the stories of President Hoover and his presidency.
You know, we're going to talk about more about the Hoover legacy in a little while, because he served during a very difficult time and was not remembered fondly after he left the White House, at least not immediately. I grew up in Iowa and really wasn't taught very much about Herbert Hoover. It's sort of like this part of our history was swept under the rug a little bit. And what are your thoughts on that entering the year of Hoover? Because he really was such a remarkable man and his wife was such a remarkable woman. They did so much outside of the White House as well. What do you want people to learn about Hoover this year?
Well, you know, these are opportunities for students and all Americans, in fact, people from around the world, to learn more about our White House, its occupants, all the presidents and first ladies that have lived there. And we do tend to keep snapshots of history that we hear along the way, or presidents become painted with the brush of one unfortunate episode, and they do have a rich history beyond that one episode, and certainly there were probably two of the most accomplished individuals, education-wise and a career outside of politics-wise, than most other presidents and first ladies. And we'll be telling a lot of those stories throughout this course. One another partnership will be with the Boys and Girls Clubs of America. As you know, President Hoover gave leadership to the Boys Clubs of America for many years post-presidency. So on March 14th, we'll be announcing a partnership with them. We have a wonderful...
Let's take a short pause and talk more about that in a moment. This hour, we're talking about the life of Lew Henry Hoover. We're also talking about the year of Hoover with the White House History Association. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're celebrating Lew Henry Hoover's birthday a little bit early. The birthday celebration's coming up on March 29th at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. We've been learning about her life, and we're also talking about the Hoover White House. This year, with the White House History Association, 2016 is the year of Hoover. And so many people will be learning a great deal about the Hoover White House this year. With me, Stuart McLaren, President of the White House History Association. Also, Tom Schwartz, director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, and Elizabeth Dinchel, who's education specialist at the Hoover Library and Museum. And I want to talk about one of Lew Henry Hoover's contributions to our historical knowledge of the White House, and that is her catalog of the White House, the Dare Stark McMullen book. And Elizabeth, can you tell us about that catalog and what it means?
Sure. We have at the library two volumes of the book. We recently found in working on it, there was a third volume that was given to Mamie Eisenhower and is missing right now. But eventually those things have a way of coming back up. As we said, working in research libraries, that's always fun. Lew went through and started cataloging objects in the White House, wanting to know more about the furnishings specifically, and had realized that it was a very large task that she probably could not undertake by herself. So she hired to work on it Dare Stark McMullen, and Dare was one of her assistants. And we have in our collections all of the original call slips from the Library of Congress, the research that Dare had gone into understanding every single object that was in the White House. One of the things they did was looked for gaps in time where there wasn't furnishings that represented a presidency. So then they would write to other places and see if they could get examples. For example, Lew had written the Adams House in Boston and said, "We don't have anything from the Adams presidency. Can you provide us with something?" And one of the descendants gave them china to add to the collections at the White House. So we've had these books and the provenance records for all of the furnishings in the White House forever. And we found that when Jacqueline Kennedy had gone through and started to do a similar thing to what Lew had done, her staff had discovered that Lew had cataloged the White House, subsequently had written the Hoover Library, and they had a facsimile copy of one of the volumes of the book. The book is bad. The copy that they have, the pictures aren't clear, things like that. So we got a volunteer, Rachel Richards. She lives in Downey, and she scanned the entire books, both volumes, the indexes and all of the provenance records for it so that we could deliver that to the White House and to the White House Historical Association as well, or the White House History Historical Association as well, so that they could start to sift through it and make sense of some of the things that we knew, because this is the most complete record of the White House pre-Truman renovation that had ever been done. Now, we know from the records that Lew had intended on publishing the catalog, and there was some legal complications that we found in the records. Lew wanted to take photographs of the White House, and the U.S. Signal Corps, which was run by the Army at the time, had said, well, we already have photographers. You can pay our photographer to take pictures. So she paid their photographer to take pictures. Well, someone had come into the U.S. Signal Corps and requested the photographs and then had run them in a magazine, and they were supposed to be Lew's pictures. So now this magazine has copyright over the photographs that Lew had paid for. And there's this very colorful correspondence exchange between Lew and the commander of the Signal Corps. And if I remember correctly, it starts off with, have you picked up this women's magazine and read it lately? Because I have, and my White House photographs are in there. What happened? And so there's this interesting exchange between them, but basically the publisher pulled out because of the question
copyright issues.
With the copyright issues, and it never went to publication. When we delivered the second volume to the White House, we learned that they never had the second volume. And the volumes are divided by presidency and by room. So depending on what you're looking for, you can look at just the Blue Room, or you could look at the Adams presidency and what they had contributed to it. And like we were talking about research libraries, we discovered so much more about Lew's contributions to historic preservation, that she had helped start the Monroe Museum in Virginia and had worked on getting copies made of the Monroe furnishings. She also helped start the First Lady's exhibit at the Smithsonian. Very interesting things that she didn't really want to take credit for, but she was obviously involved in and was very invested in preserving the history of the White House.
That's remarkable. And Stuart McLaren is here, president of the White House History Association. And Stuart, I know you have an opportunity for teachers from around the nation to learn more about White House history. And as we're learning, you're still learning about White House history. There's so much more out there. But tell me about your Teacher Institute.
Thank you so much for asking. This is a very important partnership that we have this year, working with the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum there in West Branch and other partners here in Washington, the National Archives, the Smithsonian, the American History Museum, National History Day. We're bringing together this July 30 teachers from across the country for an intensive four-day program that will teach and train and involve many of these institutions, where teachers will have the opportunity to spend many hours each day learning about White House history, focusing specifically on President and Mrs. Hoover. We do plan to take the teachers to the White House itself, where they can walk the same halls that the Hoovers walked during their years as president and first lady. And two teachers from Iowa will receive a $1,000 travel award if they apply, and they can apply through the Hoover Library website. And we look forward to welcoming these wonderful junior high and high school teachers from all over the country, but particularly the two that will be coming, we hope, from Iowa.
Absolutely. And I know, Elizabeth, you're very excited about this opportunity as well. And how are you reaching out to teachers?
Well, I have my own kind of self-contained education mailing list, but it will also go out in the Department of Education from Iowa's newsletter that goes out every month. National History Day will put it out in their teachers' mailing list, and we'll see it on social media, and it will go out. I checked this morning, and I already had a few applications from Iowa teachers, which was exciting. But Iowa teachers can go to hoover.archives.gov, and it's on the right-hand column, and they can apply for it. But like Stuart said, the partners are going to be wonderful, and we're really doing our best to keep it in line with teaching teachers how they can put some of these primary sources from presidential history and from White House history into the classroom and turn them into vibrant activities so that students are excited to learn about this part of our country's history. the White House, just thinking about the White House as we call it, using place to teach history, like reading about something that took place in the White House and then getting to sit there or stand in that room where it happened gives you goosebumps all over your body. It's just something that you really can't put into words. It's a really a tremendous feeling. I can't wait to take teachers there this summer and investigate the White House fully. It's going to be awesome.
And the deadline is April 30th.
Yes, April 30th. Applications are open now.
All right. Well, Stuart, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. I want to thank you for focusing on Lou Hoover, because we often focus on the president, but this week, and with Nancy Reagan's passing, we're reminded again the strength, the character, the role that these women play, not only in support of their husband, who has been the president, but the difference they've made in the White House and, in fact, for our country as well. So it's been a wonderful time to listen and learn more about Lou Hoover. And we're honored to feature President Hoover with our White House Christmas ornament this year and do a little bit of Lou Hoover along the way as well.
Well, Stuart McLaren, president of the White House History Association. Again, 2016 is the year of Hoover, that Christmas tree ornament. You can see pictures of it online, but also you can buy the little fire truck ornament at the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. And we just have a few minutes left here, and I want to ask each of you, because I know, Tom, you came to the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum from the Lincoln Museum, and you were a Lincoln historian, are a Lincoln historian. So you came in, you learned a great deal about Herbert Hoover and Lew Henry Hoover. Tell me what one of the first things you learned about Lew Henry Hoover that really captured your imagination. I know you love this woman. I mean, she's such a remarkable person. Tell me something that you learned early on that got you excited.
The fact that during World War I, Lou decided to take her two young sons back to the United States, but then to return to London to be with her husband. And she wrote two wonderful letters. It was like 3 in the morning, and she's writing these. And she writes to a friend of theirs from Stanford, who's a bachelor, a guy named Jackson Reynolds. And she said, "I'm writing to you and asking you to do something that I have no right to ask, and that is, will you be the guardian of our two young sons?" And she explains to him that, yes, while they're family, there are reasons not to have a family member be the guardian. And then she writes a very long letter to the eldest son, to Herbert Hoover Jr., explaining to him why she felt a need to be in London, and that she doesn't think anything's going to happen, but if something were to happen where, you know, she and Herbert were to be killed, that she wanted him to remember that they'll always be looking over them. They'll always be there. And all he's got to do is to think of her, and she'll be there to comfort him. A really touching letter. And of course, eventually they bring the kids back. But, you know, and looking at that, it's like this woman is really something. I mean, the fact that she was thinking ahead what was really best for the children, and not maybe a family member, but, you know, someone else who's not married, doesn't have kids. But she even, you know, indicates how she wants the kids brought up.
And also making the decision that she felt that her place was in London,
was helping,
working.
Helping her husband. And, of course, she was dealing with the women's lace, with the medical supplies, and also helping raise money in the States for the CRB.
Well, Elizabeth, I want to ask you, because you went through the same process. You didn't know much about Lew Henry Hoover when you came to the Hoover Library and Museum. What was one of the first things that really captured your imagination?
I really love that Lew kind of answer to her own conscience, that she didn't care how people would interpret it. She didn't care if people didn't like her. She didn't care how the press would report it. She did whatever she felt like was right. And she did it in a very executive kind of way. And in a lot of instances, she just didn't take credit for a lot of the things that she did. But, I mean, the first instant of that, and I use it to teach all the time, we talk about her having Jesse DePriest, an African-American woman, for tea in the White House. And it was the first time a woman had been invited over socially at the White House. The last time an African-American had been in the White House was 1901 with Booker T. Washington. She knew there was going to be press fallout. She knew congressional wives wouldn't like it. She organized it anyway. She did it kind of in secret. And then when the huge backlash came back from the press, she ignored them. And the whole time knowing that she was going to cause trouble, but she answered to herself. And I think that's such an incredible quality to have as a person that it really makes Lou tremendous and amazing.
As I mentioned earlier, growing up in Iowa, I didn't learn very much about Herbert Hoover. I learned nothing about Lou Henry Hoover. This just wasn't a part of Iowa history that was part of my curriculum, but it also didn't seem to be a part of our pride when I was growing up. Tom, do you think that we're coming around? Do you think that so this is the year of Hoover with the White House History Association? Is this also the time to really revisit the legacy of the Hoovers?
Yeah, and we know that when people come to the museum, the most frequent comment that they tell us, that they indicate in the guest book and that they put on social media, is that they came with very low expectations and they discovered these wonderful people. Just an amazing, expansive, inspiring story. And on Valentine's Day, I got a letter. It was dated Valentine's Day from a woman on the East Coast talking about her grandmother and during the Russian famine and wanting to let us know that it was because of Hoover and the American Relief Administration efforts that in the backwoods of Russia, she was given enough food to sustain her life that allowed her to have a productive life. This is 97 years later. Now, what motivates someone who wasn't even directly affected, you know, to do that? And I think it's because they realize the legacy. And it surprises me that Iowans don't embrace the Hoover legacy more and the stories of Lou and Herbert Hoover, because they really did so much to change the world.
And so much outside of the White House years.
Right. I mean, they showed that you can change the world through policy, but you can ultimately, it starts with yourself. I mean, Tolstoy said, everyone wants to change the world, but no one wants to start with themselves. They started with themselves, and they worked out one at a time.
This hour, we've been talking about Lou Henry Hoover in particular, and of course, Herbert Hoover, her husband as well. Tom Schwartz, director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Charity.
And Elizabeth Denschel, education specialist with the Hoover Library and Museum. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to remind everyone, March 29th is Lou Henry Hoover's birthday. The birthday celebration will be taking place at the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum with many Girl Scout cookies for all and a program at 11 o'clock in the morning about Lou Henry Hoover's photography work that she did. On April 2nd, it's Girl Scout Day, focusing on Lou Henry Hoover's life for Girl Scout troops. And also, you can find out more about the opportunity for teachers to go to Washington, D.C. and learn a great deal more about the White House and the Hoovers. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.